I've had better days, but that's okay.
What's the matter?
I just didn't feel well last night. My back was really sore, and I have no idea why. I think it's stress.
Your back?
My back. It's like a muscle in my back or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I got.
Oh, yeah?
Be careful. Mine's just been getting worse for 3 weeks. I have to go to a physical therapist tomorrow.
I just take two ibuprofen and then it goes away. It's fine.
It comes from being old, Ben.
I know. I'm catching up with you, man.
Look out. Be careful, man. You don't want...
What's that?
You don't want this, I'm telling you.
I know. No kidding. Well, anyway. I'm going to go for a swim tomorrow. That'll help. No swimming today because it's thundering and lightning.
Where do you swim?
There's a pool over in Marcus Garvey Park. It's free.
You know. You should have said the East River.
No.
And then, I remember, like, in the old days, I used to see people swimming in the Hudson all the time.
Oh,
down
God.
By the pier and stuff.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
People used to go out there to sunbathe, right, you know, on the piers, and then they would just, like, jump in the water and shit. I'd say, what, are you out of your mind to jump in the Hudson?
Well, I did a swim around the Statue of Liberty, you know, the park there. I did a swim around that maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. I like doing long distance swims. And everyone was saying, "Oh God, did you see hypodermic needles?" I'm like, "No, the water was clean." So
there you go.
There's a pool a block away from me, and then when I go out to my house out in the East End, I swim in the ocean, and that's great. I love swimming in.
That's cool.
Salt water, man. Oh, that's the best.
Yeah, there's nothing than beach.
Yeah, beach.
The beach is what's happening.
That's right.
Where, do you go to Long Island? You ever been to Naptigue?
Naptigue? No, I don't think
so. Naptigue is between Amagansett and, the end of Long Island.
It
used to be this deserted stretch of about like 15 miles, you know.
Yeah.
The last time I was out there, it was all full of houses.
Oh yeah.
It took my God. Yeah. You know, no wonder you can't get down the road.
It's the Hamptons, man.
Yeah, well, Hamptons is over.
Yeah. So I live on Shelter Island, which is right between the Hamptons, the South Fork, and the North Fork, which has become like a Napa Valley, although the New York wine really isn't very good.
That's still pretty cool, Shelter Island. Right.
Yeah, Shelter Island. The only way you can get to it is by ferry. We drive our car up onto the ferry and go.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay.
Well, sure. You want to take another crack at trying to get a paragraph or two here?
Well, here's what I'm going to do. I've got a bunch of paragraphs. I don't know if Paula showed you what I sent her.
No, she did not.
Oh, my God. Bad girl. And it was a draft, and I added a couple more things into that. So I see this as kind of like two or three parts. And the first part is like talking about... you know, just who you are and what you mean, and you know, the whole idea of you painting when you were a child and not being a self promoter and all this stuff. You know, kind of like a taste of Bob Newirth. Basically, you know, based on my conversations with you and then some stuff that I found, including I found this in Chronicle Volume 1, you know, the Dylan thing there?
Yeah.
He wrote, like Kerouac had immortalized Neil Cassidy in On the Road, somebody should have immortalized Newirth. If ever there was a Renaissance man leaping in and out of things, he would have to be it.
Yeah, well, that's Dylan, you know, like,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Mythologizing himself, you know. Really.
That's probably true. Yeah, he does do that. So anyway, what I was thinking of doing is, I know that in the website that you have now, there's a lot of reference to various things, and then there's a discography. But the discography is on your website is based on when it was reissued and stuff like that. So I've chronologically put them together. And what I was thinking of doing is, people don't want to read long paragraphs at a certain point. So what I wanted to do was just to kind of do some bullet points and just ask you about, very, like, thumbnail sketch reflections on it. Is that cool?
Yeah, well, listen, I've only made about 5 or 6 records, right?
Well, let's see. We'll start with 1974, Bob Neuwirth. And then
1974. Come on. Oh, yeah. And on
Asylum Records. Yep, on Asylum. And then Back to the Front, 1988 on Gold Mountain.
Yeah.
3 years later, 99 Monkeys. I'm including into the mix Last Day on Earth because I think it's pretty cool.
What happened after 99 Monkeys? What's the next one?
Last Day on Earth. 94,
really?
Yeah. So then it's 96, which is Look Up, which I really, if you could give me some quotes on that, it sounds like a really interesting project. Then from Look Up, it goes to Havana Midnight. And
yeah.
then, as far as your own albums, that's it. But then you have influences with D.A. Pennebaker, Baker. And then the tour with T-Bone, The Great High Mountain, the Harry Smith Anthology, contributing to the tribute to the songs of Alejandro Escovedo, Rogues Gallery, the Vince Bell Project last year. So I think you have a total of just your albums, one, two,
probably five,
three,
or six, right?
Four, five, six.
Okay.
Okay. So
yeah, and then like the other stuff is like the Alejandro album. What's the Hal Wilmer one about the sea chanties?
Oh, Rogues Gallery, Pirate Ballads, Sea Songs and Chanties.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's
the Harry Smith Anthology.
The Harry Smith Anthologies.
Yep. So.
And then, I'm trying to think if any other appearances.
Yeah, and then I'm really interested too toward the end about stories and songs. Those are the concerts you've been doing the last.
Which one is that?
Stories and songs, the concerts. I have it. I research it, and I see from 2014 to 2016.
What was that, Stories and Songs?
I don't know. It's just some shows that you put on where you, I think it was at your concert.
Oh, where I did it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then what's that album that about, Another Place, Another Time?
I don't know that. What is that?
That's one of the music from, That's from a concert we did at Town Hall. It was and it's the music from, what was it? From some Cohen. Other Side of Llewyn Davis.
The Other Side of Llewyn Davis?
You know that movie, Another Side of, Inside
oh,
of Llewyn
yeah,
Davis?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that Another Place, Another Time was the music from that movie. In other words, retakes on a lot of folk songs from supposedly the 60s in the village.
And what year did that? I wasn't a big fan of that movie, but that's okay.
That's easily fact-checked, That's,
okay, good.
That was like a Town Hall.
Okay, cool. And it was called Another Place, Another Time?
I think it was probably 2017 or something.
Okay, good.
Those, like, some of those, anything that you think of or you've run across, jot it down, and, like, what's not cool, we'll just drop it.
Yeah. But, you know, I just wanted to do these, like, bullet points so that people can kind of look. And it's,
Good idea.
I'm calling a timeline. And, you know, so I'm going to start off with your peripatetic lifestyle from Akron, Ohio, which is, you know, your autobiography. But to Paris.
Well, you know, we could just say.
Go ahead.
Born in Ohio. We don't have to give everybody my email address, you know.
Yeah, but you
just say born in the Midwest, you know, and having gone to art school in Boston.
Yeah.
At the Museum School, I mean School of Museum of Fine Arts.
School of Museum of Fine Arts.
Yeah, the Boston Museum School is the way it's known. You know, a lot of people went there. Poons went there.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
So it was called the School of the Museum of Fine Arts?
The Boston Museum School.
Okay.
Of Fine Arts. I think that's the official title these days.
Okay.
It's completely different than it was when I was when I was young, you know, like I got. When I went there, it was a small little school on the Fenway, and it was really pretty cool, you know.
So then from there, you went to Boston, then you went to Paris, then you went to Berkeley, then you went to Greenwich Village, then you went to L.A. Any like, jolting short stories? Paula was saying that you'd be up some interesting short stories of playing on the Paris streets.
Yeah, but I mean, Paul has a romantic idea of like how much information people want from a website.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of great stories about all that period of time. And, you know, like for a jaded older girl, you know, like they're of great interest to her, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because she has a sensibility to, like, you know what the stories represent, but I don't think they're like necessarily relevant to a bio, you know?
Okay, cool. Okay.
I'm glad to talk about them to anybody, you know? But,
well,
like,
when I do that Rolling Stone article on you, we can talk about it then. Yeah?
Yeah, or the, you know, the book or whatever. But, you know, like, it's just, I don't think that necessarily telling all those stories about, you know, I'll think of some way to tell it to you in a short form. While we're doing this, I'm not in a particular rush for this. I don't know what your schedule is like. Maybe you're in the middle of a novel or something. But.
Well, I'm in the middle of it wasn't a back burner, and now I'm trying to put it onto the front burner. A book on the jazz period of Joni Mitchell's career. 1974 to 1980. So,
well, whatever, so it doesn't interfere with your.
No, this is.
I mean, it's so fucking hard to write, you know.
Well,
I know that. You know, it's hard to. It's hard to paint.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's hard to like. Yeah. It's hard to perform. It's hard. All of that stuff. Everybody looks at it. Looks so easy.
Yeah.
It's like when you watch a hockey game on TV or something, or a football game or a baseball game. It all looks like, oh, yeah, I could do that. See somebody throw a 100-mile-an-hour fastball.
But you can't dunk. No dunking for you.
Huh?
No dunking for you.
No dunking.
Yeah. Basketball.
You know, or you see, you know, you look at people surfing and you think, yeah, man, I like to surf some big waves, you know. You get to the beach and you go, oh, I don't know, maybe I'll stay on the beach and watch, you know. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
Just, yeah, I'll take my boogie board out as long as I don't have to. Sometimes I have to save my own life every set, you know. Anyway.
Okay, so here goes. Let's do the albums and just you know, like, just thumbnail sketch, you know.
Let's do the first album.
Yes.
First album was for David Geffen's Asylum Records.
Yep.
And you know, he said, there's no budget. Go ahead and make the album that you want to make. And I hired everybody I ever in the world wanted to hear play. You know, like the horn section was a guy, you know, who played honky-tonk and, you know. And you know, like everybody on it was, all the musicians on it were sensational.
Yeah.
You know, I sang a duet. I mean, I don't want this in the bio necessarily, but, you know, I sang a duet with Don Everly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because one night we were inspired. I mean, we spent a lot of money on this album. I got to give Dave Geffen credit for never, you know, he didn't promote it, but on the other hand, he never really, you know,
yeah,
bitched and complained about how much money we spent, you know. It was the most expensive record ever made at the time, I think. You know, pretty sure about that. And there was some acts on it.
Yeah, so tell me.
I'd love to remix it myself today. You know, I'd like to replace the singer for one thing. That was that adventure, and it
okay.
was.
Well, tell me
I
this.
I wasn't ready to. I'm sorry.
No, tell me this. Mercedes-Benz.
Well, that was on there. You know, that was a joke song.
Yeah.
That was a song that we made up in a bar. You know, and Janice had that song, and
she
had the beginnings of it because Michael McClure had a poem that went that way. And Michael had been hanging out with one of the Hell's Angels, you know, making music, you know, following the example of Allen Ginsberg, who had followed the suggestion of Dylan, you know. So,
yeah.
I don't know, all these poets suddenly thought they were singers. And anyway, she just had the first part of it, and then, you know, we were drunk between shows one night. We just finished it off, and she sang it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, just for fun to this audience, right? And there's a whole story behind it I don't want to get into. And then when she was recording her last album, Pearl.
Yeah.
At one point. And to keep the musicians happy and, you know, entertain them. You know, she, oh, here's my new song, and she sang it. And in those days, you know, we used to have a quarter-inch tape running in case somebody did something brilliant, you know, we could catch it on. And anyway, it got taped. And then when she died, they didn't really have enough for an album, you know. In fact, that whole album, Pearl, those are all work vocals.
Wow.
You know, that's all the genius of Paul Rothschild to make it sound like a real album.
Wow.
They weren't the vocals, you know, and the songs weren't necessarily completed. And he just threw that one in because it was a space filler, and it was kind of a personal touch, you know, with a cackle at the end and stuff. And, you know, then the album came out, and lo and behold, you know.
That became a hit.
Yeah, well, not a hit, but it became one of those campfire songs. You know, I get emails all the time of people who say, my uncle wrote that song. You know, my grandpa says that he wrote, is that true? You know, and I just like, you know, it's another one of the kind of genre of emails that you just have to kind of ignore, you know, when it comes to information at bobnewirth.com. And you just, I can't answer those questions, you know. There's like all kinds. I get those kind of crackpot emails all the time. So that was that. And I didn't think anything more about that.
Yeah. Let me go ahead a couple years before we go to the next album, which is years and years and years. I read what's his name, Steve Solder or whatever his name, talked about the Art Experience sessions that you had down in the Bitter End.
What's this?
Those sessions that you had, it was 75, 76, 75. where at the bitter end, where you would just invite people.
Sessions?
Yeah, they call it, somebody called them an art experience sessions, yeah. Where you would just, you were just inviting people, anybody off the street to come and play.
Yeah, you know, it was another thing to pass the time in the summer. Summer in the city, man, you know, in the village, it was hot and sticky and nothing going on, and you know, Paul Colby, I just stopped by the city, I don't know why. I ran into Dylan in the bar, and then, you know, I had a new song or something, I got up on the stage and sang, and then Colby, you know, this is too long for the bio too, yeah. But for background, you know,
yeah.
This guy, Paul Colby, I said, well, let me play here next week. I'll be the opening act. And he goes, we already have an opening act. We'll be at the bottom of the bill. You know? So anyway, I started playing there, and then it was just like one of those loosey-goosey summers, you know. And people started dropping by. And, pretty, you know, and it was like, I mean, it was, I'm not going to say who was on the bills and stuff, but with kind of it was kind of unfortunate for some of them because people started hanging out for these jam sessions and then leaving afterwards,
uh-huh.
You know? And out of that all came, you know, a drunken idea of let's take this on the road, you know? We'll do it in station wagons. And we'll just pull in and we'll do it in the local folk club and then we'll just get back in the car and drive to the next town. And it germinated into Rolling Thunder, you know.
Very cool.
It just got larger, you know.
Yeah.
And the more fun we were all having, it got, well, we can't go. At first it was going to be Dylan and I and Ramblin' Jack. Then we thought, no, well, we ought to take, you know, this guy, he can play, and that guy, and, oh, she can sing. She's got to come with us. And pretty soon, you know, there was no way to not get a bus. And then some people got involved and turned it into a production.
Good.
And then we thought, well, let's film it, you know?
Yeah.
And so then a bunch of film people started. I mean, everybody was volunteering too, man. I mean, this wasn't like a movie.
Yeah.
Rolling Thunder. I mean, it wasn't. That's a fictional movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one thing that's not fiction in that movie that's on Netflix is the music.
Yeah, yeah.
The rest of it's all made up. You know, people weren't even.
I know.
You know, Sharon Stone.
I know. That's so funny. That's so funny.
Or Bette Midler's husband, you know, who plays the filmmaker. You know, none of those people were around.
Cool. Okay.
But, you know, like, that's what took up that time. And then, you know, that all led to 99 Monkeys.
No, it led to Back to the Front.
Oh, Back to the Front. I'm sorry. That's,
88.
It all led to Back to the Front.
Yeah, which is...
And it happened because we were all... Souls and I were hanging out in Santa Monica. We were playing with a tape recorder in his living room. And we just recorded a couple songs. And then Danny Goldberg was someplace along the line. Said, well, if it doesn't cost me any money, I'll put it out. He had this cool label called Gold Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Gold Castle or something.
Hey, Gold Mountain. I remember it.
Yeah, and it had... That cool people on it, like Judy Collins and Joe Baez and Liza Gilkison.
Yeah, I got
it. So that sounds like legitimate, you know, because we just did it in Soul's living room. Literally, on a tape recorder, on a reel for reel.
Cool.
And okay. We had a certain amount of stuff that wasn't completely objectionable, you know. we gave it to Danny, put it out.
Cool.
And then, you know, a couple of years later, we did 99.
Yeah.
Monkeys.
Tell me, wait, just another thing on Back to the Front. It was really interesting the way it works. There's the banjo introduction, and then there's the harmonica end.
Say that again. I'm the hard of
the,
hearing.
The banjo introduction on Back to the Front, and then the harmonica end. It's really nice. It's a really nice way to have the album go.
Well, the banjo intro was because, you know, I'm a five-string banjo aficionado, and that was Birdie, you know, Ledden from the Eagles.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end, the harmonica thing at the end was Mickey Raphael from Willie Nelson's band.
Uh-huh.
And the dedication for PB, it was for Paul Butterfield.
Oh.
Because he had passed away, you know.
Yeah.
And we all loved him, you know, so that's what that was all about. It wasn't Beau Carranza. So it's like, you know, whatever.
Okay, so that was 88, and then 3 years later you did 99 Monkeys, which I think...
Yes, a couple of years later we decided to try to catch Lightning in a Bottle again. I don't think we did, but there were some ideas in there that were preservable.
Really?
And like I said before, you know, I've been privileged to make these albums with no strings attached.
Yeah.
You know, like Geffen said, there's no budget. You know, do what you want. And then Danny said, you know, if it doesn't cost me anything, I'll put it out. And then some other people wanted to do some stuff, and so 99 Monkeys. Oh, did we get a Look Up? Is that in there?
Hold on. Look Up's coming. Coming down.
Okay.
Coming down the road.
Okay, because that was a similar thing.
I'm interested in hearing about that. Well, that's good. You have a jazz tune. I don't know which tune it is, but on 99 Monkeys, and I'm listening, I'm going, oh my God, it's a jazz tune.
What's what?
It's a jazz tune.
I didn't quite get that.
In 99 Monkeys, as I'm listening to it on Spotify, because I don't have the album, and all of a sudden there's like kind of an instrumental that is really jazzy. Yeah?
An instrumental?
Yeah. Was I hearing things?
Is that in the middle of it?
Yeah.
What kind of an instrumental?
I don't know. It just felt jazzy to me, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. It doesn't ring a bell, but, you know, maybe I ought to check out my own, you know, detritus every once in a while.
Okay, let's go to Last Day on Earth, which is after 99 Monkeys, which came out in 91. 94 was Last Day on Earth, and that was the collaboration with John Cale for the was commissioned by the Art at St. Anne's in New York, right?
Yeah, that was Cale called me up one time and said, let's make an album, you know. I mean, we've been talking about doing something for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And we had tried. He had a record label at one point. We had recorded a couple of sides for that record label. We just had wanted to collaborate on something.
Uh-huh.
And so this is like the lady from Arts at St. Anne's, you know?
Uh-huh.
And she, and John, she liked John, and she, so we, anyway, we met for drinks one afternoon, and she said, well, John said, well, we have a project. And she said, oh, really? And she said, what's the name of it? And I said, The Last Day on Earth. and we hadn't even talked about it. And she said, okay, great. You know, like, when can we expect to do something with it? And she arranged for us to work at BAM.
Uh-huh.
You know, BAM in those days was kind of like very empty and quiet during the day.
Uh-huh.
Nobody was going out to Brooklyn that much, you know, and So we had this big space. We moved some, you know, instruments in there, and John and I just sat down and wrote that. And I think it's great, you know, and it should have gone to Broadway, I think, you know. It would have been a great avant-garde musical. But it was a little far out for Universal.
Yeah.
At the time, they didn't know what the fuck I'd make of it. And Paula was involved. She worked at Universal at that yeah. particular point. And what's her name? You know, oh, man, this is awful.
Don't worry about it.
Well, she was the head of product or something for Universal at the time. And she had known John when he was on Universal years before. Nelson, Kathy Nelson. And so between the two of them, they got it okayed.
Wow.
You know, they got us a budget for it. And so we, first we did it in concert.
Yeah.
At Arts at St. Anne's in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. in the church there.
Yeah.
St. Anne's. And then we made a record of it. Yeah,
that was
pretty cool.
Yeah, I've heard about it, and when I was talking with Paula yesterday, I said, I can't find that any place, you know, I just want to like listen to it. And she goes, oh, we have plenty of copies, I'll send you a copy, so.
Did you check all the usual suspects?
Did I? Yeah, I looked around.
Yeah,
I looked
like
around.
Amazon? Did you look it up on Amazon?
You know, I don't know. I just couldn't find any information on it either, you know. But
well, you know, it's Universal. It was Universal Pictures, I almost said. It was MCA, excuse me.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's what I got. Yeah.
And they didn't, it was a kind of like... It's definitely still in the red on their books. But I think they just wanted to get it off the books. You know? I don't know, like, there's some copies around someplace, but I mean, it...
Well, Paul's going to send me it. And
it's meant to be listened to from beginning to end, like the Vince Bell record, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like... You know, are you familiar with that Carla Bley? Did I mention this to you or Paula? That Carla Bley album that came out in 70, Escalator Over the Hill. It's like three.
Whose album?
Carla Bley.
Oh, Carla Bley.
Yeah, and it's wild. It's like it's just from that era, you know. And it sounds like I'm really interested in this kind of stuff, so I will get it.
Well, it's amazing, Dan, as you know, from as a music appreciator, right?
Yeah.
Like when you go to a jazz club, or even more important, like when you go to the symphony. I think we touched on.
Yeah.
And you first of all, you realize how fucking loud it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like psychedelically loud. And the second thing is you realize that, like, all these people are listening to each other.
Yeah.
You know? And one guy is controlling it, and if he doesn't like it, you know, if he doesn't like what you're playing, you know, if you're second trombone or something, you know, and you play a clam, you know, he just... sends you to the men's room. You know? He sends you to the corner, you know, with a dunce cap on. You know, it's another experience. You know, this is why I hate digital stuff.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk
digital
about that.
Digital stuff is not music.
Yeah. We'll talk about that when I do the article.
Establish that poll quote. Digital recordings are not music. They are ones and zeros that penetrate your ear on some level, you know, that's not meant for humans. You know, there are no nuances in digital.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, I'll get that in there. I'll get that in there someplace. But now I wanna go to look up 96.
Okay.
And that was like it was a large cast, and you recorded it in various spots in different people's apartments and stuff like that.
Well,
right?
You know, there was a guy in Texas, and Heinz Geisler. Hmm? And he had a record company called Watermelon Records.
Right, yeah. Still around, I think.
And he'd always, like, been saying, you know, Tish would be great to have Bob Lewis records. And so one time I got tired of him saying that. You know, he was a friend of some friends. You know, he knew everybody, including Alejandro. About Alejandro's music and Steve Young, you know, who's one of the underappreciated musicians of our recent times. And, you know, he said, you know, I said, I'll tell you what, you know, you give me some money, I'll give you an album. You know, and oh, and he did. You know, and he said, what studio are you going to use? And I said, I'm going to buy plane tickets. So, so I bought a Datman recorder and, you know, some other toys of some kind or other. And I just went around and recorded places.
Yeah.
You know, and he was great with all of that, you know. And it's all direct to digital, and it's all, you know, I don't think there's any overdubs or trimming on it. There's one song on one of those albums where Barbara Streisand let us use her studio to do a digital edit.
Really?
And it's, with that exception, you know, that's not really a pull quote, but with that one exception, you know, the, it was direct to digital.
Wow.
You know, these things. And, which was, you know, in the realm of art, man.
Very cool. You know?
Yeah. And, I don't know, what's the next album?
Okay, 99, Havana Midnight, which is like, let me read you this quote. This is from, I went to Amazon to just kind of scope it out. And this, here's the quote. Bob Newhart's long and fitful career is built around ragged but soulful folk-based recordings that are marked by an ingrained extemporaneous spirit. Newhart, after all, is a dyed-in-the-wood troubadour who's more interested in capturing the moment than artfully shaping his songs. I like that.
Who wrote
quote.
That?
This guy's name is Stephen Stolder. He was just writing these things for Amazon.com. And he was celebrating the fact that you were working with a collaborator who was taking these... you know, capturing the moments and artfully shaping the songs, I guess, is what his point was.
This is for Havana Midnight, right?
Yeah. That's a great record.
Yeah, it is. It's a great record because of Jose Maria.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, it's not a great record because I'm on it. That's for sure. But, like, you know, we recorded it in Havana.
Uh-huh.
And I recorded it on one of the two, you know, big studios there where they did music soundtracks for movies and stuff. And Jose Maria is like a really well-known composer.
Yep.
His family are really famous poets, his mother and dad. I mean, like, you know, like Garcia, what's his name, you know?
Oh, yeah. The Mexican writer. Yeah?
They, you know, like, Latin cultures really love poetry.
Yeah.
They love it.
Yeah.
They love it. And I got to see Gabriel. Gabriel Garcia, you know. No, you know, like the guy. Anyway, you know, his parents are like, you know, high-level... Yeah.
And so how did that connection come up between the two of you?
How did what?
How did you connect with him? How did you guys decide
to do
this?
Well, man, it's another one of those long and twined stories, you know, where I went to a concert at Lincoln Center, and it had these Cuban bands, right?
Uh-huh.
And, there were three Cuban bands on the bill, and they were smoking, man. You know, I mean, they had me out of my chair boogieing, and I don't do that. I don't dance in public, you know, for sure. And afterwards, there was this critic from the New York Times. And I don't know whether to drop his name or not. You know, Paula could make that decision. But he was, at the time, he was a music critic for the New York Times. Paula knew him, and after the concert, he said, "What'd you think of that?" You know, and I said, "Wow, man, you know, like, I'd like to record with this guy. This is like the most rock and roll shit I've heard in 40 years, you know." And he said, "Oh," he says, "I'll introduce you to my girlfriend." He was a married guy, you know, so I probably don't want to get too deep into this. He said, "My girlfriend's from Havana. She's a star now, by the way." Yeah. She's a big star in this. Anyway. Paula can tell you all about that. You know, anyway, she said, you know, "Well, I'm going to Havana next week, you know, one day or two." She said, "If you give me an album, I'll give it to Jose Maria Vitier." So then she said, "He's more of your generation." You know, and I thought, oh, fuck, put the knife in a little deeper, you know. But in any case, I gave her, like, a couple albums. I don't remember what they were, maybe Back to the Front and something else, you know. Uh-huh. And see, the next thing I knew, man, you know, I get this communication from Cuba, right? It's Jose Maria, you know, it's coming to the U.S. Some other Cuban bands are coming to play you know, the Seven Sister Colleges?
Yeah.
Somebody had put together a little Cuban tour of those colleges.
Uh-huh.
And these people were coming, and Jose Maria was one of them. You know, this was back in the day, they were kind of desperate to come to the U.S. under any circumstances, you know. And you couldn't go to Cuba. So anyway, they were playing at Holyoke or I can't remember, someplace. And Paula and I drove up there to see them. And we went. We got there in time for sound check, and they were, you know, like, I went to the stage and said, "Where's Jose Maria?" You know, I said, "Oh, he's smoking a cigarette outside." You know, so I went out in the alley and. There's a guy out there puffing away furiously on a cigarette, you know. I go, "Are you Jose Maria?" He goes, "Yes, are you Bob?" He says, "Yes," and we just both start laughing, you know. So I thought, well, this is pretty cool, you know. So anyway, we gave a ride back to the city. They were heavily minded and all that shit, but I don't know. We just ignored all that, you know. And we said, "Well, come on, we'll give you we said, "Well, where are you staying?" You know, and they were staying in this fucking motel, man, with a half-filled pool of ice. You know, but the ice was like brown, swampy water. You know, and all the young Cuban kids were having a ball, right? And Jose Maria and his wife, who were adults, you know, we're like a little nonplussed by the whole thing. So we put them in a hotel where we're staying.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I can't remember what city it was, but it was a nice enough hotel, you know. And they were really kind of appreciative of that. So we said, "Well, why don't you ride back to the city with us?" I found out that Jose Maria is a big baseball fan and everything. He was asking about the Yankees. I said, "Well, we're driving right past Yankee Stadium." You know? "So why don't you come with us?" Anyway, one thing led to another, you know. And he said, and we went over to Mansfield's house, right?
Uh-huh.
And this is off the record, but we went over to Mansfield's studio. Mansfield had a little studio over by the United Nations. And by this time, you know, Jose Maria is starting to, like, you know, smell fish here because I didn't know enough about music. I mean, you know, really, you know, I'm not hiding my light. I wasn't up to his level, you know. He's really smart about music and all these players and stuff. So he says, well, you know, play me some songs, you know, that you might like to record. So we went over to Mansfield, and everything was twisty, and they were scared, you know, to be in the city.
Uh-huh.
And we had escaped the miners. We hadn't escaped them, but, you know, they were missing from the carass, you know, and out running around with Paula and I. And so we go to this play, they were kind of nervous, like they really thought, you know, they were going to be bugged on the streets like that. You know, Jose Maria was hiding his wallet. So, you know, because his wife was nervous. But anyway, so we go to Manny's and, you know, we walk in and the first thing he sees is this little award from the Havana Film Festival.
Uh-huh.
And Mansfield had won for the, you know, the for the, you know, not the song of the year, but the score of the year, right? For this guy that he works with in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
What the fuck is this guy's name? This guy's name is like, I'll think of it, you know, but it's a funny combination of Mexican and Jewish name, you know. Anyway, so like, so they see that and then they start laughing because they go, I had the same award, you know. So we sit down and we play these songs, you know. I play them these songs and I see it, it's like crestfallen, you know. And if it hadn't been for Mansfield, I'm sure the two of them would have just run away, you know. Because it was the standard of music was just so far below them, you know, below what Jose Maria does. So I played him, and he said, well, you know, I'll tell you what. He says, I'm going to arrange some song. He said, of the albums that you gave me, he says, is there any song that you'd like to record again, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I can't remember what the song was now, but I said, yeah, I'd like to record the first time, I think it's called. And I said, I'd like to record that again. He said, let me make an arrangement and see if you like it. You know, see if anything, if we can work together, you know. So they kind of left and they went back. And oh, they wanted to go to 48th Street and get a keyboard and shit. and they didn't believe that Manny's would really deliver it to their flight, you know. Shit, but sure they were getting ripped off. And so then the next thing I know, I get like an invite from the Minister of Culture, you know, saying, well, you're invited at no cost to you and to come and work with Jose Maria Vitier on a project, you know, like, and it passed clearance with the State Department because there's no money changing hands.
Right? Uh-huh.
So the next thing I know, I'm in Cuba, you know, at his house. And he's got a guitar tutor. He said, oh, man, I bought you a present. I go, oh, I got one of these. Yeah, well, we have to use it. And so he says, play that song, you know. So I played the song, and he goes, well, I said, that's not the same song. He said, play the song. And he starts smoking more furiously. And so I played it again. He goes, oh, once again, that's not the song, Bob. I go, yes, it is, man. He goes, no. He says, every time you play it different. And I go, yeah. You know, because I thought, you know, I thought what we were going to do is set my DAT recorder up on the kitchen table and get a couple of local conga players in or something.
Uh-huh.
Record in this kitchen like I'd made the other albums, right? And he said, no. He says, he's like going to slap his head and say, well, we have much work to do. And he played me the arrangement of the song, and it just blew my ass off, man. I said, I can't live up to this. You know, and then, you know, they had this you know, we're staying in the guest room, you know, it's kind of ratty guest room, and they had a TV set with rabbit ears, you know?
Yeah.
With, like, aluminum foil wrapped around it.
Uh-huh.
Because, like, you know, I had no TV business in Cuba. You know, they were, like, they were pirating all their TV signals from the satellites. And anyway, so this show was on. I mean, you know who Silvio Rodriguez is?
Absolutely, yeah, sure.
Okay, so Silvio was on TV, right?
Wow.
And Jose Maria's wife comes in. She goes, "Bob, Bob, put on your TV." You know, Silvio's on. So I turn it on. You know, we're watching Silvio, and she says, "That's the guitar player that Jose Maria wants to use with you."
Wow.
The guitar player was so fucking great that I just said, you know, I'm not opening my guitar case. You know? In fact, I might go back to the U.S. in the morning, you know, because this guy was just so fucking great. He's the guy that's on Havana Midnight.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And now we have to go to the studio, right? And these guys are all sitting there. And they're the best players in fucking Havana, man. They're from all different bands and stuff. The bass player is from, the name of that, what the fuck? My brain is like a steel silver. But the percussion player is like, Don Poncho was this famous Cuban musician who walked through the streets of Havana playing his chicharre, you know, and the little kids would trail him like the Pied Piper of Hamelin and shit. And, I mean, it was just, the violin player was like, you know, they're just all insane, you know, insanely great. And I just was like, what do we do now, you know? And it was like, it was a race to see who would have a nervous breakdown first, you know, Jose Maria or me. Because they didn't know how to play three-chord songs, you know, without the clave, you know, or in my rhythm, you know, set. And I certainly couldn't keep up with what they were doing. So, you know, Jose Maria and I just kind of looked at each other after that first day and went, whoa, you know, we're into something here that's never been done before. Because, you know, like, there's a lot of people who have gone and stuff.
Yeah.
But they've all been very high-level musicians, and they've always somehow played around with the clave, you know?
Yeah.
Or at least classical stylings, you know, or jazz stylings, for that matter. And you know, here was this kind of, like, you know, savage American folk singer, you know, with these indecipherable songs, you know. But everybody was, you know, we got into it, Matt. And we made it in 5 days, you know. I think there's two or three songs on there that I had when we started. The rest of them were all, you know, done. And, you know, I got hung up telling you the story because it was, you know, it was such an enjoyable time for me, you know.
Oh,
and all the musicians were so excellent. Like, they didn't know how to jam. There's a jam on the end of that record. And it was the first time they'd ever tried to jam. That's not what they do, you know.
Yeah.
They don't do that sort of fucking thing. By the way, all kinds of weird people started dropping by the studio. Totally weird. Peter Yarrow's niece, for instance, God knows what she was doing there, you know. But, like, I mean, one day I went to the studio and said, there's a girl here to see you. You know, they were, like, giving me that look of, like, what kind of spy is this, you know. And, because they had their security lurking around all the time.
Yeah.
Not security, but they're spies, you know, basically.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was really an adventure, dude. I mean, someday when we're sitting over a beer, you know, I'll tell you in detail you know, what it was like to be there and do that. You know, it was like, it was something, you know. But anyway.
Cool. Okay.
Maybe you got a sentence out of there someplace.
Oh, no. Yeah. But a lot of stuff to kind of like consider down the road for something else. How about that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to... there's a lot of stuff in here. Like 2000, you did Down from the Mountain with D.A. Pennebaker. You did the Great High Mountain Tour with T-Bone.
I was a musical director of that.
Yeah. And then the Harry Smith Anthology Concerts and Film, and the Alejandro Escovedo, Rogues Gallery, Vince Bell. I'm going to just drop those in there, okay? Without...
Sure, you can do whatever you want. I mean,
But now I want you to tell me about stories and songs.
Nothing. It's just literally that.
Really?
You know, stories and songs, you know, just...
Okay.
You know, like, I mean, I have some stories that are unusual, in quotes. Like, have you ever been kissed by Miles Davis?
Never.
And, it's an experience, you know. And totally unexpected, and because I had given him a watercolor.
Really?
You know, yeah. You know, like, I'll tell you the story, but it's also not for the fight.
Yeah.
You know, like, you remember when Miles was on that long sabbatical?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And when he came back, he played in what was called Studio 54.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They had turned it into a more of a club, you know, music venue. And Paula had this friend, Cheryl, whose last name is evading me at the moment. And she was writing a story for People magazine, I think.
Uh-huh.
Or some legitimate slick, you know, and she called up and said, you know, Miles Davis is playing his first show the Studio 54 tonight. Would you like to go as my date?
Oh.
I go, please let me think about it, yes. You know, so we went down there, you know, like all the big wigs and Bucky Bucks were there, you know, Rolling Stones and people like that. And anyway, Miles came out, and you know, like, if you've ever saw Miles, I mean, he is like a magic man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's like a charisma incarnate.
Yeah.
So I played this thing, and afterwards she said, well, let's go say hello to him. Said, what? And she'd been accepted by him at that point.
Uh-huh.
You know? So, anyway, so we went backstage and, you know, met Miles and everything. He was hot and sweaty and distracted and being mobbed. And so we left, you know, when I got home, I was making little watercolors all the time at that point, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I had a little briefcase for, like a briefcase full of art supplies, you know, watercolors and stuff. So I went home and I was like, I was blown away, man, by the shit that he did. Because he started songs that had no trajectory and just, you know, he was part of, you know, he was doing what I think is high art, you know.
Yeah.
Where you just, like Keith Jarrett, Cone concerts.
Yeah.
You just start. And you have no idea what the fuck is going to happen. This band that he had assembled, I think Mike Stern was in it. I'm not exactly sure. Anyway, he'd just start playing something, and then people would fall in, and then they would somehow find a tempo, and then Niles would grab a fucking melody out of the air or something. I don't know, it was just magic shit.
Uh-huh.
And I was very inspired. I went home and I was making watercolors. And so Cheryl called and said, well, do you want to go again tomorrow? You know, or are you done with it? I go, So we went back the next night, you know. And after the show, you know, we went upstairs and I gave Miles this watercolor I'd made. Uh-huh. And it goes into his dressing room, right? Now we're sitting there like, you know what the backstage of Studio 54 is like? Uh-huh. There's no real backstage, right? It's like, you know, stairway.
Yeah.
And so we're like outside waiting for him to come out. He's soaking wet, dripping wet.
Yeah.
And he goes in, you know, to his dressing room. And he's in there for a long fucking time, man, like 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
We're standing there like gourds, you know, and security's keeping everybody else off the staircase or away from him. And so then, you know, he opens the door and he says to Cheryl, you know, Why he give me that? And she said, because he loves you, Miles. And he grabbed me and kissed me, man. It was a soaking wet Miles Davis, who was a tiny little fucker anyway.
Yeah.
He grabbed me and kissed me in the mouth, you know. And I go, what the fuck? You know, where has art led me this time? You know? And, anyway, you know, like he was, and he would turn out he was just starting to paint stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But that was his way of saying thanks. I'll tell you this other real quick Miles Davis story that also is not in the background. You know, I was at this party once at Christofferson's manager's house, third block, in Central Park South. And, you know, he was married to Barbara Carroll. The piano player.
Uh-huh.
And they had this party, you know. Again, I don't know, maybe it was for Chris' birthday party or something. But it was one of those real New York City, Central Park South, you know, one of those buildings there, you know, like where Jerry Wexler kind of lived in much. and so then the doorbell rings, you know, and it's a kind of a cocktail, New York City, you know, A primo, you know, proto, whatever. And the doorbell rings, and somebody answers the door. Bert goes to the door and something, and it's Miles, man. And he's come to the fucking party. And, you know, like the room goes dead silent when Marlon walks in, or Dylan, or somebody, you know. And hold on. Let me just see what Paula wants. Hold there, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, Miles comes in and then the party slowly, you know. Now, you know, like I'm not feeling it at this party at all, you know. Everybody's kind of like a little old and a little, you know, what's a club, you know, that everybody belongs to, Jerry Lewis, you know, kind of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, anyway, so they're kind of that kind of celebrity level, you know, New York sophisticates, you know. And so I go in the bedroom where all the coats are on the bed and shit, and I'm watching the Knicks are on TV.
Huh?
So I'm like, great, you know, quiet, empty room. I don't have to be polite to anybody, you know, like just. Nobody from the Friars Club is going to ask me why I'm there. And the door opens and Miles comes in. And now, like, I'm sitting on the foot of the bed close to the TV. watching the Knicks, right? Miles comes in and he sits down behind me by the head of the bed. And he picks up the phone and he takes out his little black book and he starts calling chicks, man. Oh, baby, yeah, it's Miles. You know, what you doing later? You know, you want to come by? Oh, you know, I can't. Sorry, baby. Another time. Click and dial somebody else, you know. And he's talking all like in this in Miles' whispery voice, right? And now I'm trying, I don't want to leave the room.
Yeah.
But I'm also trying not to listen to him. I'm leaning towards the TV. Suddenly, after about, you know, I don't know, 10 minutes or something like that, I feel this whack in the middle of my shoulder blade, you know? From behind me, right? And I'll whip around and it's in Miles, he said, he's got this devilish grin on his face and he says, I'm talking to you, motherfucker. And I thought he was on the phone to some chick. He'd been trying to get my fucking attention.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it was like off-putting to say the least, you know. But whatever, man. I mean, I have a couple of Miles Davis stories, you know.
That's great.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, Miles Davis is one of the gods to me.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing like him. And he had a Ferrari.
Oh, my God, I know.
So, anyway, those are side stories for later, right?
Right. Okay, one final question for you, because I have to go make dinner for my wife.
After you what? You making a sandwich?
I have to go make dinner for my wife.
Yeah.
But what are you doing now? You said, oh, I don't want to have anything in Rolling Stone because, you know, there's nothing, you know.
Well, I lost my painting studio, which happens to me on a periodic basis.
You lost your what?
I just wind up for one reason or another without a painting studio.
Ah.
Which I don't have at the moment, you know, so I haven't been making visual art for a while. But I've been writing songs again.
Oh, cool.
So I got a bunch of new songs. This time, did you hear the Vince Mill record, the OHO record?
Yeah. I wrote that thing about it, yeah.
Well, so this time, I'm going to record, you know, and filter, you know, or I'm going to segue or, you know, whatever. That's not the right word. Modulate more in that direction, you know? I mean, I want to record, like, I want to surpass Atlanta Midnight musicianship.
Uh-huh.
So I want to get, you know, I may do some stripped-down, skeletal, sort of semi, I don't know what you call them. They're not really country. They're not really folk. They're just kind of naive music. And I may record a couple of those kind of things, you know, with just, say, Mansfield and Dave Soldier or something. But I also want to make some of these songs, and I've been pitching them to people and stuff. But, like, I know the song's great. But like I give them to somebody like Marianne Faithful, you know, with Wilder producing down in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And the fucking guitar player tries to take my song and turn it into a normal song. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's supposed to be filled with bridges and stuff, you know. It's supposed to be all over the place. But she couldn't grasp it. She would have had this great voice for it. Anyway. So I'm going to take the stuff that I have, the material that I have that's in that realm, you know, and get Rob Schwimmer to go to work on it, you know.
Cool.
With his keyboard, you know, whatever, you know. Anyway, here's my suggestion. You mulch, because there's such large chunks of what I've been babbling about that we don't want to really use.
Yep.
You mulch what you can find into the next edition, and then we'll see if there is anything, I have some other ideas I want to talk over with you anyway.
Cool.
Some other things I think I want to put into a biography.
Cool.
And we'll have another run at it, okay?
Yeah. Well, what I'm going to do...
okay with you because...
Well, you've given me so much stuff, and I can see it. I've got, like, a little outline in front of me, and I'm just going to go in there and get the tasty bits, and I think...
Yeah, the problem is those little anecdotes, you know, and stuff. They're all okay, you know? Like, if I put them in a New Yorker magazine, you know, 400 words, but, you know... For a biography or something that somebody who doesn't have a clue who I am goes to a website, I want to, you know, like this is all still kind of crystallizing for me.
Yeah, okay.
You know, because I don't know how to talk about myself really. But I want to give you some good stuff and I want it to be good when we're done. So if you don't mind, let's have another crack at it.
Sounds good.
And why don't you just tell me when it's convenient for you, because I'll make time for it.
Well, you know what I'm going to do tomorrow is I'm going to take what we talked about today and I'm going to do another draft, and I'll send it to Paula. And I think I have your email address now, too. I'll send it that way, and I'll send it to both of you by the end of the day tomorrow. And then, we'll look
like
and see
I
what
said,
we got.
No hurry on my part, so... Let's just see if we're making progress. Don't worry about it, okay, Dan?
I think we're making progress, Bob.
Okay, man. Well, listen, don't worry about the end result.
Okay. Okay. My wife
All right?
is...
Yeah, I mean,
no problem.
And the rewards will be there no matter what, so...
Absolutely. And there's more miles to go, I'm thinking.
Okay, Dan.
All right, man. My wife's
have
home.
Have supper. Say hi to your wife.
Take care. Hi, she's saying hi. Bye. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Okay. Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, honey. How are you?
Good. I'm better.